It is 7:09 in the Twin Cities, 46 degrees. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. Later this hour, I'm going to be chatting with David Hughes. He is the Republican candidate who is running against Congressman Collin Peterson in the 7th Congressional District. That's an enormous district that basically takes up the entire sort of western half of Minnesota. And just this past week, Real Clear Politics, which is a very well-respected website that analyzes political races, has moved that race into a toss-up. So yet another congressional race that, a lot of people are looking at here in Minnesota. And also we'll be chatting with Jeff Johnson. He, of course, is the Republican candidate for Minnesota governor. But this half hour, we are going to visit with Sue Abderholden. She is the executive director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I had wanted to talk to her about Everson Griffin, who, of course, the Vikings were very clear that he was dealing with mental health issues. And I thought it was such a transparent moment for the Vikings to actually acknowledge that and really to treat it as just another illness, which, of course, it is. But I did want to ask Sue, who I've talked to many times, just about some of the recent events. And anytime there is a mass shooting or certainly pipe bombs being mailed, there's always this sort of talk about mental illness and violence and the link, and is there a connection or is there not a connection? And no one's better to talk about it with than Sue. So Sue Abderholden, executive director of NAMI Minnesota, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Esme.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, it comes up every single time there's one of these horrific mass shootings. What is your take on the debate or the connection or not lack of connection between mental illness, gun violence, and mass shootings?
Well, I think the thing that we have to remember is that we have 1 in 5 people who are affected by mental illness, and they're just not all violent.
Right.
And so we have to be really, really careful about connecting the two, because every time we do, we make it even more difficult for someone to acknowledge that they have symptoms and to seek treatment. And usually when you really look into the details of the mass shootings, what they really have in common is that they're white, they're male, they're obsessed with violent video games and guns, and it's not necessarily due to their mental illness. And many of them actually don't have a diagnosed mental illness. So, you know, people with depression don't go out and kill people, right? That's just not, they're more likely to take their own lives. And so, you know, they said the Las Vegas shooter, you know, perhaps had depression. Well, it wasn't the depression that caused them to kill people.
Right. And I think that's an important point. And I guess, so what you're saying is that, you know, every time this discussion comes up, the vast majority of people who do have a mental illness are not violent. And so it stigmatizes it even further.
Yes, absolutely it does. And it doesn't help us understand why it happened.
Right. In terms of just overall, you know, the battle, and one of the things that NAMI does is put out sort of resources and, you know, education and support for families. What is the status of the overall picture here in Minnesota in terms of the kind of treatment options that are available, especially in some of our rural areas, in terms of insurance coverage, in terms of that education component going forward?
Well, we like to say that our mental health system isn't broken. We never built it. And so, I mean, we didn't have one before. The state hospitals were not a mental health system. And I would say that we've made a lot of progress over the last 40 years. We have more services and access to treatment than we ever did before, but we're still not meeting the needs. In rural Minnesota, you have a serious workforce shortage. You know, there aren't psychiatrists hardly anywhere in the state, but you're also missing psychologists and even clinical social workers. And so people often have to wait a long time before they can access treatment. And I think when we look at culturally specific communities as well, we don't have culturally competent mental health, enough of them. So that can really delay access. And then I think kind of the
And when you say that, are you talking about, you know, people who have a background in for various ethnic groups and or immigrant groups?
Yes. So people from those communities, and also not enough of our mental health professionals have had real training in being culturally competent.
Interesting.
And
all
so
right.
that can, you know, really be a problem. But I think overall what we see is that people can't access the right care at the right time.
Right.
And so, you know, we have people in an acute inpatient hospital who are waiting for something in the community. And then we have people in the emergency room waiting for that hospital bed. So it's a flow issue, trying to make sure people get to the right place at the right time.
We're talking with Sue Adlerholden. She is the executive director of NAMI Minnesota. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. How does Minnesota stack up compared to other states in terms of the resources that are available on a statewide level?
Actually, very well. The National Mental Health Association, Mental Health America, actually came out with a report recently, and we were number one.
Really?
You're
citing what you feel are still our deficiencies. So if we're number one, you have to think about what might be the problems in other places.
Exactly. So, you know, it's all relative, of course. And I would say it isn't like there's another state I would go to. We have pockets of excellence. So you might see that, you know, for example, Illinois just passed a great mental health parity enforcement law. We have a lot more CIT-trained officers in Ohio. So we have these, like, little pockets of things, but it's not like there's one state that's doing it great in everything.
Wow. Okay. And do you think that there's a lot of receptiveness to trying to improve the situation, whether it's at the state level or the federal level or the local level?
I would say generally yes. You know, I've been with NAMI 17 years, and when I think about back when I first started, what they even talked about in terms of public policies or people sharing their stories was very limited. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a legislator or an elected official who would say that we don't need to spend more time and attention and money on our mental health system. I think people really understand what the great needs are and what we can do to really address them.
Right. So I want to take a quick break, and then I would like to talk about the Vikings kind of going public and Everson Griffin going public about the fact that he was struggling with a mental illness and your impact on that. And what does it mean something when somebody who's very well known is open and honest about what their struggle is? So keep it right here, folks. So we're chatting with Sue Adlerholden. She's the executive director of NAMI Minnesota. It is 7:20, 45 degrees in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. We're chatting with Sue Adlerholden. She is the executive director of NAMI Minnesota. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So what was your reaction to Everson Griffin and the Vikings going public with the fact that he was battling a mental illness?
So I was really pleased to see that. I think often we look at athletes and, you know, you're supposed to be strong and kind of invincible. And so to talk about something like mental illness, I think, is really important. Now, so I'm going to admit I don't watch a lot of sports, but I don't
a lot of people
time.
Do, though.
A lot of people do. But I want to be careful about saying whether he really has totally shared his story. What I've seen is he said he was struggling with some issues, but I haven't seen anything where he said, I have a mental illness and I was treated. I think what we have, all, of course, all assumed that, and I think we have to give him time, frankly, to heal and decide to tell a story. But I think what we saw was an employer responding to clearly some type of crisis with empathy and understanding and support.
And is that what you get from most employers?
Unfortunately, no. Although we're starting to see a change there, too. We have some large companies in our state who are really looking at this differently. We just had actually Grand Casino. NAMI gave them an award today, an Employer of the Year award, because they really did focus on the mental health of their employees. We know.
Let me ask you, what were some of the things that Grand Casino was doing to focus on the mental health of their employees?
So they actually trained some of their employees to be more knowledgeable about mental illness. They wore green ribbons so that other employees know that they could talk to them. They have quotes in the employee lounge. They had a resource area that people could go to. They did a lot of suicide prevention training. They've trained some of their staff in cultural healing. So they really took that extra step to make sure that at least in their place of employment, people could actually talk about their mental health.
So people wear green ribbons, and you can talk to them. And then what did you say about the lounge?
So they had information about different mental illnesses and about what treatment and what resources were available in their community.
Wow, in the employee lounge, that's pretty cool. Good for them.
Yes,
but that's so that you actually recognize them with an award today.
Yes, yeah. But we have other companies, Best Buy, Ernst & Young. Both of them have gone out of their way to provide resources and to talk about mental health. Up in War Road, Minnesota, I think it's a snowmobile manufacturer up there, something like that. They also have done a lot of work on making sure their employees understand what good mental health is and what the resources are. I think because we have a very low unemployment rate that, you know, you have to make sure that the employees you have are doing well.
Right. And that's actually an interesting point, that because we do have such a low unemployment rate, that might be sort of an amenity that people, or a service that people are providing to their employees as
yes.
an incentive to come work there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, that knowing that your employer cares about your mental health, you know, wants you to have some breaks from your email after 6 o'clock, that they encourage you to, you know, watch your nutrition and to exercise and all those things. It's a good thing for everyone.
Absolutely. What is the status of insurance coverage for mental health issues?
Well, unfortunately, we still are not enforcing mental health parity. There was a new national report that came out just a couple weeks ago that gave Minnesota an F in terms of enforcing mental health parity. Now, there were over
20 states that
also got an F.
Yeah, is the law?
So what the law says is that if you cover mental health or substance use disorder treatment, that you have to do it in the same way. So you can't have different out-of-pocket costs like co-payments or deductibles. You can't have arbitrary treatment limits. And then you have to treat it the same way. They call it non-quantitative treatment limits. So you can't have different formularies. You have to add new types of treatment in the same way. If they pay for rehab for your new hip, they should pay rehab for someone with schizophrenia leaving the hospital. And frankly, that's the area that we have the most trouble with in terms of enforcement.
Even though, is that a state law or federal law?
It's both, and it's been there for 10 years.
Let me ask you this. How about the access part? Because I know that there are a lot of plans that provide mental health coverage, but they only have like 4 providers in the state or something like, or in the metro.
Yeah.
I mean, where does that fall under?
So that's actually called network adequacy. And so in Minnesota, the law is for primary care and mental health that you have to have someone within 30 miles or 30 minutes. But it doesn't mean that they're taking new patients. And so it's kind of a strange law, and it's something that we're looking at because I think that health plan should have to attest that actually who's ever in your network is taking new patients, because otherwise who cares?
Right. And I think that's the thing, is that a lot of people have, you know, whereas that they can go to pretty much any most clinics or whatever, the mental health providers are far more limited in terms of the available that they can go to on their plan. I think a lot of people face that as well. And I think that makes it very tough.
Yes. And then they go out of network and have to pay more out of pocket.
Right. Right. But that's you're saying that's allowed under the law.
Yes, it is, unfortunately.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, that's something that obviously it'd be nice to see that change. Tell us about where people can find you and look at the resources. You do have a lot of resources available.
Yes. Yeah, so our website is NAMIMNforMinnesota.org, and there's actually a health library. We have under publications, there's booklets helping explain what's inpatient psychiatric care, how to manage a crisis, you know, what happens if your loved one is arrested. We also now offer online classes and on web-based support groups. So if people can't attend one in person, they can look to do it that way. And we have a helpline. It's not a crisis line, but it is a helpline. So people can contact us if they need help kind of maneuvering the mental health system. And our phone number is simply 651-645-2948.
All right. And let me give that again. 651, if you can give that again, Sue.
Yep, 651-645-2948.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. Again, that line is 651-645-2948. Thank you, as always, Sue. We really appreciate your coming on.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me, Esme. I always enjoy talking with you.
Absolutely. All right, that is Sue Abderholden with NAMI. All right, folks, we're going to have to take a break. We're going to give you some weather. And then when we come back, we're going to be joined by David Hughes. He is the Republican candidate in Minnesota's sprawling 7th Congressional District. He's running against veteran Congressman Colin Peterson. And also we'll be joined by Jeff Johnson, who, of course, is running for governor. So keep it here, News Radio 830 WCCO. All right, folks, 7:31 in the Twin Cities. A lot going on. Election Day, finally, just a couple of days away. There is a lot of attention on Minnesota's congressional races, and there is an outlier that I'm surprised it has not gotten more attention. But just this past week, Real Clear Politics, which is an excellent website that has a lot of great political information on it, it is a neutral site. In other words, it doesn't skew Republican or Democratic, actually put the 7th Congressional District as a toss-up. The 7th Congressional District has been represented in Congress for many, many years, I think 30-plus, by Congressman Colin Peterson. He is a Democrat. Donald Trump won this district by 31 percentage points in 2016. Dave Hughes was running against Congressman Peterson 2 years ago and lost by, I think, about 5 percentage points. Dave Hughes is running again, and again, Real Clear Politics has put this as a toss-up race. Dave Hughes joining us now. Dave, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Esme. Great to be here with you.
Absolutely. Let me ask you, where are you joining us from?
I'm in Moorhead right now. Today is day 9 on the trail. We've been all over the place, all the way south to Pipestone, all the way east to Albany, everywhere in between. And we're hitting the campaign trail hard, meeting a lot of folks. And we really have a sense the momentum is with us. And we're gonna pull this out on Tuesday.
Well, you did run 2 years ago and you lost. It was, you know, a relatively tight race. I mean, Colin Peterson has won races by double digits easily. Many times he's run for re-election. You only lost by 5 percentage points. What are you seeing in terms of the crowd reaction and just what kind of a feel are you getting compared to 2 years ago?
Well, two things. One, 2 years ago it was pretty lonely. It was just my wife and I. We had no money. And, you know, we would go everywhere and just kind of get these blank stares. And so between the average
voter, you did pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. But the difference is this year we're getting a lot more enthusiasm. It seems like the average voter out there that I meet everywhere we go has not only heard of me, but they're really excited. And, you know, they all say the same thing this year, which is that, hey, I know Colin. I like him. I've voted for him in the past. But he's been there too long, and we're ready for a change. And that really is what I'm hearing all the time. The other aspect is that the party organization and the activists and everybody involved are much more excited this time than 2 years ago. And so we're very positive and confident right now.
I do want to let everyone know that I did reach out to Representative Colin Peterson's campaign today, both by email and by phone. Did not hear back. Let me ask you, in terms of overall, how the race is going, do you have any idea why Real Clear Politics, which is a very well-respected site that analyzes races, why they moved you into the toss-up slot? Because I haven't seen any independent polling in your race.
Right. No, the answer to your question is we don't know. We've reached out to Real Clear Politics several times over the last few days to try to answer your question, and we haven't been able to connect with them.
Okay, because and in some ways, this is one of these districts, and Minnesota happens to have a number of them, where when you look at how the president did and you look at the fact that there's a Democrat who's holding the seat, it's off. And the president did better in the 7th Congressional District than I think in any other district. He won by 31 percentage points. Are you finding a lot of support for the president, I mean, compared to 2 years ago, or even more support than 2 years ago?
I think it's as high, if not higher, than 2 years ago. You know, not only are the Trump supporters enthusiastic, but, you know, I think all this nonstop attack on the president by the mainstream media, you know, mostly at the national level for the last 2 years, has had a backlash here in Western Minnesota. And so folks are as energized or more. And I think that's really been helping my campaign.
Well, you know, I will say that I did talk to Minnesota House Speaker Kurt Dowd, and he was saying that the polling that the Republican Party has done shows that in the areas where Mr. Trump was very popular and did very well 2 years ago, he's even more popular, which would support what you're saying. You're a 21-year veteran of the United States Air Force. You work for General Atomics as an MQ-9 UAS drone instructor pilot, which sounds very impressive. You fly operational missions for the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. In terms of Colin Peterson's record, Colin Peterson has been running ads that have continued to run actually in our market as well, about the fact that he is an independent voice, that he votes for the Republicans when the Republicans are right, and he votes with the Democrats when the Democrats are right. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think there's a little bit of cynicism there and just numbers playing. You know, everybody keeps saying that he votes against his own party 36% of the time, but it hasn't had any real impact. I mean, name a bill that the Democrats really wanted to pass in recent years that passed just because of Colin, or name one that the Republicans really wanted to pass that passed just because of him. It doesn't matter a whole lot. And frankly, you know, in the last 8 years that his party has been in the minority in the U.S. House, Colin has authored exactly 3 bills that have become law. A lot of folks in the media, they talk about all this clout that he supposedly has. But in 8 years, he's passed 3 bills. 2 of them were to name buildings, one a courthouse, one a VA facility, and one was a Native American issue. And so, you know, none of those 3 are of a huge amount of impact in Western Minnesota, certainly not for agriculture, which is the number one economic sector here. So I just don't see a lot of clout there. And so, you know, the choice is clear that folks can vote for me and I'll be, I'll have the ear of the president and secretary of agriculture Perdue on day one in 2019. And I think people are ready for that.
Well, if the House goes Democratic, which I think a lot of people think it will, Colin Peterson would be chair of the Agricultural Committee in the House of Representatives. That would be a lot of clout.
Well, that would be a lot of clout. But the gamble is this, you know, the voters of Western Minnesota are pretty energized and pretty disgusted with the performance of the Senate Democrats on the Judiciary Committee with the whole Kavanaugh confirmation hearing. And so you've got that, and you've got the prospect of what Nancy Pelosi has made clear as her agenda if she becomes Speaker again, right, which is to reverse the tax cuts of a year ago, open the borders, grant amnesty, and all sorts of things that I don't think the people of Western Minnesota really want.
Let me ask you, in terms of you described, you know, when we started, you started out that really you're seeing an energized electorate there. Was there a change after the Kavanaugh hearing, or has it just been pretty consistent throughout?
Well, I think there was a change after the Kavanaugh hearings. I mean, it's sort of anecdotal, but we've seen it spread far and wide. And that was, I mean, just as something as simple as yard signs. We had reports that a number of the counties in our district had quite a few signs remaining just prior to the Kavanaugh debacle. And as soon as that came to a head and shortly thereafter, we got new reports that, bam, those signs are flying out of the victory centers and flying out of the county locations, and they're all over the place now. And we have very few signs that haven't been posted yet. So for what that's worth, I think that's a great indication of the energy out here in reaction to the whole Kavanaugh scandal.
All right. Well, Dave Hughes, and you are going to be, I think, in Hutchinson on election night. Is that right?
Yes, my wife and I are going to vote up in our town of Carlstad, Minnesota.
Which is way, way, way north up by kind of Roseau and War Road. I actually looked it up on the map there.
Yeah, so we're going to vote there Tuesday morning, and then we're going to make our way down with stops in between, and then stop off in Hutchinson, and then at some point in the evening probably dash down to Bloomington to join the Republicans down there for the victory celebration.
Well, that would be great because we obviously will be covering there. And to be honest, it's actually logistics of covering this election for WCCO TV. It's difficult because there are so many races that are up in the air that are so spread out. So that would be great if we did see you down there in Bloomington as well. And obviously we love going to the 7th Congressional District where I caught up with you earlier just a couple months ago. Anyway, Dave Hughes, thank you so much for joining us. And obviously you're very busy. We appreciate your time this evening.
Esme, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And it was fun meeting with you out at that dairy not too long ago.
Absolutely. All right. That is Dave Hughes. He is the Republican candidate in the 7th Congressional District. It's a district that has suddenly been moved to a toss-up by Real Clear Politics. He's running against Congressman Colin Peterson, the longtime incumbent. Again, we did reach out to Congressman Peterson and did not hear back today. All right, folks, we are going to take a break. When we come back, we should be joined by Jeff Johnson. He, of course, is running on the Republican ticket to be the next governor of the state of Minnesota. It is 7:43 in the Twin Cities, 45 degrees. Well, as I have been saying, Election Day, just a couple of days away. I think a lot of people are ready for it, and I'm sure the candidates are. Right now, we are going to be joined by Jeff Johnson, who is the Republican candidate for governor of Minnesota. Commissioner Johnson, how are you this evening?
Good. How are you, Esme?
Pretty well, sir. You must be ready for this to be about over.
Yeah, we're about there. I'm actually in the RV. We're heading back from Stillwater after a couple days, I think 13 or 14 stops the last couple days.
Wow.
And we're heading out tomorrow morning, and we'll come back on Election Day and hit another 20 or so. So it's been great, and this is kind of the easy part of the campaign. You don't really think about anything anymore. You just go talk to people. But I'm ready.
And I do want to say that we did reach out to Congressman Walz, who obviously is the Democratic candidate for Minnesota governor. He is up on the Iron Range where there's limited cell phone service. So I do want to let everyone know that we did reach out to him. Overall, I mean, how are things going in these final days? I mean, the polls certainly have shown you consistently trailing Congressman Walz.
Yeah, I feel like things are going extremely well. And I don't put much weight into polls. I was down by 19 points to Tim Pawlenty about
That's true.
And I won by 9. So they were only off by 28. And that was, you know, the last national poll. So, you know, there have been some good polls, there have been some bad polls, and I don't pay any attention to them. I know what I feel out there. We've talked to tens of thousands of Minnesotans, and there is a real desire for something different in state government, and that's not even partisan. It's not just Republicans. I'm hearing that from Democrats and a lot of people in the middle. They feel like Minnesota government is no longer accountable to taxpayers. We've got this long history of good government, however you define that, in Minnesota. And we seem to have lost that to a certain extent, and that encourages me because we're talking about changing the status quo in this race, and I think people are open to that.
All right. And what you mentioned about the polls, I think, is really true. I mean, as you said, you were down. I mean, everybody thought, you know, Governor Tim Pawlenty was going to kind of walk away with it. Maybe obviously not you and your supporters, but a lot of people did. Certainly people in my profession thought that Governor Pawlenty would have an easy time, and he didn't. And you were absolutely right. I mean, he was up by, I think, as you mentioned, 19 points. You won by 9. And I think a lot of these polls, I feel increasingly a lot of these polls have been wrong and are wrong. I'm not sure what exactly it is. I think you've got the same day voter registration here in Minnesota,
yep,
which has a big impact. And you also have, obviously, a lot of people now who have cell phones. And I think that's yep, kind of skewed a lot of the polls. But overall, in terms of how things have been going, I know you're a big supporter of the president's. As you travel around the state, where are you seeing, are you seeing strong support for President Trump?
I am, and it really depends on where you go, and it's fairly predictable. I don't think it'll shock anybody that when you get away from the Twin Cities, the support is much stronger. You get into western Minnesota especially, and up on the range, the support for him is tremendous, probably more so than 2 years ago when he won the election, when he won the election and almost won Minnesota. And, you know, you have areas of the state where he's not terribly popular, including the area that I live, which is Plymouth, the western suburbs. There's people are pretty uneasy. So it really depends on where you're at. I do think there are people, I know there are people that don't talk about their support for him because they don't want to be attacked for it, but they are happy with the results, even if they're uncomfortable sometimes with the style.
The style, the president's style. Well, I know that you support his policies, but I can't think of, I can't think of two politicians with sort of a different style than you and the president. I mean, that's not your style at all. The sort of the bombastic, that he seems to revel in and continues to revel in. In terms of, you know, state government, I think a lot of people have been pretty fed up with the gridlock over in St. Paul. What can you do, and what do you think you'll be able to do to kind of unlock that?
Well, I honestly think it's all about the leadership style of a governor, and it does come down to the governor, because you can have, you know, great leaders in the legislature or rotten leaders in the legislature. If you don't have a strong, engaged governor, you're going to have a mess at the end of session. And unfortunately, we seem to have come to accept the fact that every session is going to end in chaos. And
well, it does.
Backroom deal. And, you know, a big monster omnibus bill that no one's read, and then half the time special session, which we shouldn't put up with that. We shouldn't have to put up with that. And I think if you have a governor who is very engaged from the start of the session, not just at the end, and is working across the aisle, I mean, we're going to fight about things. There's no way around that, because some things are worth fighting about. But there's so many things we agree on. And what frustrates me the most is there are all these bipartisan agreements on, you know, very important things, and instead of getting them done, they all get pushed into one huge bill at the end, because they think if we put the good stuff in this big bill, then the governor's going to have to sign the bad stuff, or the legislators are going to have to vote for the bad stuff too. And that's what's led to this mess at the end. And, you know, you get the governor vetoing stuff that he actually agreed with, because it was all shoved into one big bill at the end. So I think if you have a governor who can focus first in the session on, hey, what are these things we agree on? You know what? We can all agree that we need to come up with some sort of solution to the opioid crisis. So let's go get that done, rather than save it for the end as, you know, candy to get votes for something else. And then at the end, yeah, we're going to disagree on some stuff, and we'll have to hammer that out. But let's not put everything off to the end.
All right. And, you know, one of the issues here is you've got divided government, though. I mean, you know, Governor Mark Dayton was elected handily. I mean, he beat you, and but you've got the legislature that's controlled by Republicans. I mean, unless you have, and it's possible that the House could switch, the right. Minnesota State House could switch to Democratic control. So if you were to win, you could be facing divided government again.
Sure, and that, you know, I mean, that's what we've had, I don't know, probably 80% of the time in Minnesota, if not more. I think Minnesotans actually have, in the past, kind of suggested they like that. They don't want one party to control. I mean, I would love to have an all-Republican legislature and me as governor, but that might not happen. And, you know, you go back 20, 30 years, sessions didn't end this way, and they had divided government then. So it's very possible. But again, I think it really comes down to some leadership from a governor who can say, listen, let's figure out what we agree on first, and get those things done, and then we'll battle it out at the end over, you know, some big and important things. But at least the good stuff won't get lost in that process.
I know, you know, there have obviously been a ton of ads in your race and all the races, but I know that you were particularly upset about an ad that ran, one of the ads, the more recent ads that suggested that you took issue with how they categorize your position on health care. Can you explain that for us?
Sure. There's a group called Alliance for a Better Minnesota. It is pumped in. They're going to, in the end, they're going to spend probably $4.5 million on a set of ads against me. And these are the ads that everybody's seen, because they've been running heavy for months, where in almost all of them, it's a woman saying, you know, Jeff's going to take away coverage for pre-existing conditions. That's has found to have been false. I mean, it is false, because I can tell you I won't do that. And we've guaranteed affordable coverage for people with pre-existing conditions for 30 years in Minnesota. So just a value we have, but they keep running it. And you know what? It's politics. People lie. I get it. But last week they came out with the new ad 1 week before the election day, figuring, well, it's too late, you know, for anybody to do much about it. And it has a disabled, very disabled young man who comes on and says, you know, if Jeff had been governor and I was a kid, he would have denied coverage to me as a poor disabled child. And that to me is just beyond the pale. That is a new low. It's not just false. It's not just a lie. But all of a sudden now you're going to attack phase where nobody would deny health coverage to poor disabled children. I certainly wouldn't. And, you know, we never have in Minnesota. And I think using someone like this to scare disabled people is pretty pathetic. I think it's really sad, and I think it's too bad that at least one side seems to think it's okay that Minnesota is going to go down this road that unfortunately other states have gone.
Well, there have been negative ads on both sides, you know, yes. From these, especially from these independent groups.
Yeah, I haven't seen any negative ad on the other side, that on our side, that is even marginally close to that. First of all, I don't think anyone's accused ads on our side, which are much fewer, frankly, of being dishonest, number one, and certainly nothing as vile as using a disabled person to suggest that you're such a rotten human being that you would take health care away from disabled kids who don't have money.
Let me ask you about the early voting numbers that have come out across the state, because it shows really an incredible surge. I think if you add up all the early votes from last Thursday, it was, and then also sort of mail-in ballots that are very popular in more rural areas, you've got about 585,000 people that have already voted or are in the process of voting. It's probably much higher than that now with Friday and Saturday, you know, people yesterday and today voting as well. What do you think that means? Is that just an example of people getting used to the fact that you can have no excuses voting? Or does that mean something else, that there really is going to be an increase, that we're going to top the 50% that we had, or 51% of turnout in the last midterm elections of 2014?
I think it's the latter. I mean, it's a combination of both. Clearly, people are starting to become more comfortable with early voting and understand it and realize you can skip the long lines on Tuesday. But I think it also suggests that we are going to have much higher turnout. We saw it in the primaries. Both Democrats and Republicans had, you know, higher turnout than we've seen in decades. And I feel it as I travel around the state. I mean, I don't think anybody doubts that Democrats and those on the left are energized right now because of their feelings about Donald Trump. And I think there was some concern a few months ago that maybe Republicans or conservatives wouldn't have that same energy. But that has changed, and there are probably a bunch of different factors. But I would say a month or so ago, we started feeling it out there that all of a sudden those on the right, those to the right of center, seem just as energized as those on the left. So I think we're going to see much higher turnout than 4 years ago. And I'm guessing we're going to be back at where we were, you know, 10, 12, 15 years ago when we were, you know, more like the 60% range for a midterm election, which I think is great.
Interesting. Let me ask you, I mean, obviously this is more sort of a federal issue, but was it the Kavanaugh hearings? Because we just had Dave Hughes on, who is of course, the Republican candidate running against Colin Peterson. His race has suddenly been moved to a toss-up by a very well-respected group, Real Clear Politics. He thinks it was the Kavanaugh hearings that really, he could sense a difference there. I mean, was that really a factor?
I think that was absolutely part of it. I don't know if that's the whole thing. I think part of it is just we're getting closer to the election, and those, you know, Republicans and those right of center recognize the consequences of my race, at least. But certainly we saw it after the Kavanaugh hearings. A lot of people were really disgusted by what they saw and said, you know what, we're paying attention now. And that may be a lot of the people who are voting early.
Right. Right. Well, and certainly those numbers are there. And I think most people that I've talked to, you know, on both sides sort of agree with what you're saying, that they're seeing an energy there that certainly suggests that on both sides, people are ready to take a stand and, you know, make their decision. Well, Jeff Johnson, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're very busy and you're kind of shuttling between things. I guess the next few days, though, it's going to be kind of nonstop.
It is, and it's again, this is the easy and fun part of the campaign, so I appreciate you giving me a few minutes.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much, Commissioner Jeff Johnson, the Republican candidate for Minnesota governor. We appreciate your time this evening.
Thanks, Esme.
All right. Absolutely. All right, folks. And again, we did reach out to Congressman Tim Walz, who is way up in the Iron Range where there is limited cell service. So I do want to let you know that we did reach out to him to see if he was available. I know he's been on. David Josephson, our producer, is saying that he has been on recently on WCCO radio.
Yeah, Tim was in studio with Dave Lee just
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, there you go. Doesn't get any bigger than that, in studio with Dave Lee. But obviously, one of the marquee races that we're going to be deciding here, and that's what I think is so – I think it's great that people are energized. It's great to hear – Commissioner Johnson say people are energized. We heard Angie Craig earlier, Democrats say people are energized. I think it's good because there is a lot at stake, and there are sharp differences in the political parties, and you get to decide. You get to decide and make that decision, and there's so much at stake with all these elections. You've got that governor's race. You've got the two U.S. Senate races that are so critical, and you've got now these five And I don't mean to marginalize, you know, the three congressional districts, Betty McCollum and obviously not yet Representative Ilhan Omar, who's running for Keith Ellison's seat. I mean, it's difficult to believe that Republicans would have a chance in that district because it's so overwhelming Democratic, and also Congressman Tom Emmer. I don't mean to marginalize their districts, but you have five districts that are in play here, and that's just amazing in a state our size to think that of the eight congressional districts, five are in play, and those five districts really could determine who controls the U.S. House of Representatives. Listen, I'm going to be talking about all of this with my friend Professor David Schultz coming up in just a few moments. Keep it here, News Radio 830.